Chapter 8. From the bridge, it was 30 miles to Port Reprieve. They met the road again 6 miles outside the town. It crossed under them and disappeared into the forest again to circle out round the high ground, taking the easier route into Port Reprieve. But the railroad climbed up the hills in a series of traverses and came out at the top 600 feet above the town. On the stony slopes, the forest found meagre purchase, and the vegetation was sparser. It did not obscure the view. Standing on the roof, Bruce looked out across the Lufira swamps to the north, a vastness of poisonous green swamp grass and open water disappearing into the blue heat haze without any sign of ending. From its southern extremity it was drained by the Lufira River. The river was half a mile wide, deep olive green, ruffled darker by eddies of wind across its surface, fenced into the very edge of the water by a solid barrier of dense river bush. In the angle formed by the swamp and the river was a headland which protected the natural harbour of Port Reprieve. The town was on a spit of land, the harbour on one side and a smaller swamp on the other. The road came round the right-hand side of the hills, crossed a causeway over the swamp, and entered the single street of the town from the far side. There were 3 large buildings in the centre of the town, opposite the railway yard, their iron roofs bright beacons in the sunlight, and clustered round them were perhaps 50 smaller thatched dwellings. Down on the edge of the harbour was a long shed, obviously a workshop, and 2 jetties ran out into the water. The diamond dredgers were moored alongside, 3 of them, ungainly black hulks with high superstructures and blunt ends. It was a place of heat and fever and swamp smells, an ugly little village by a green reptile river. "Nice place to retire," Mike Haig grunted. "Or open a health resort," said Bruce. Beyond the causeway, on the main headland, there was another cluster of buildings, just the tops showing above the forest. Among them rose the copper-clad spire of a church. "Mission station," guessed Bruce. "St. Augustine's," agreed Ruffy. "My first wife's little brother got himself educated there. He's an attaché to the Ministry of something or other in Elizabethville now, doing damn good for himself," boasting a little. "Bully for him," said Bruce. The train had started angling down the hills towards the town. "Well, I reckon we've made it, boss." "I reckon also. All we have to do is get back again." "Yes, sir, I reckon that's all." And they ran into the town. There were more than 40 people in the crowd that lined the platform to welcome them. "We'll have a heavy load on the way home," thought Bruce as he ran his eye over them. He saw the bright spots of women's dresses in the throng. Bruce counted 4 of them. "That's another complication. One day I hope I find something in this life that turns out exactly as expected. Something that will run smoothly and evenly through to its right and logical conclusion." Some hope, he decided. Some bloody hope. The joy and relief of the men and women on the platform was pathetically apparent in their greetings. Most of the women were crying, and the men ran beside the train like small boys as it slid in along the raised concrete platform. All of them were of mixed blood, Bruce noted. They varied in colour from creamy yellow to charcoal. The Belgians had certainly left much to be remembered by. Standing back from the throng, a little aloof from the general jollification, was a half-blooded Belgian. There was an air of authority about him that was unmistakable. On one side of him stood a large, bosomy woman of his own advanced age, darker skinned than he was, but Bruce saw immediately that she was his wife. At his other hand stood a figure dressed in a white open-necked shirt and blue jeans that Bruce at first thought was a boy, until the head turned, and he saw the long plume of dark hair that hung down her back, and the unmanly double pressure beneath the white shirt. The train stopped, and Bruce jumped down onto the platform and laughingly pushed his way through the crowds towards the Belgian. Despite a year in the Congo, Bruce had not grown accustomed to being kissed by someone who had not shaved for 2 or 3 days, and who smelled strongly of garlic and cheap tobacco. This atrocity was committed upon him 12 times or more before he arrived before the Belgian. "The good Lord bless you for coming to our aid, Monsieur Captain. The Belgian recognised the twin bars on the front of Bruce's helmet and held out his hand. Bruce had expected another kiss, so he accepted the handshake with relief. "I am only glad that we're in time," he answered. "May I introduce myself? Martin Boussier, district manager of Union Minière Corporation, and this is my wife, Madame Boussier." He was a tall man, but unlike his wife, sparsely fleshed. His hair was completely silver, and his skin folded, toughened and browned by a life under the equatorial sun. Bruce took an instant liking to him. Madame Boussier pressed her bulk against Bruce and kissed him heartily. Her moustache was too soft to cause him discomfort, and she smelled of toilet soap, which was a distinct improvement, decided Bruce. "May I also present Madame Cartier?" And for the first time, Bruce looked squarely at the girl. A number of things registered in his mind simultaneously. The paleness of her skin, which was not unhealthy, but had an opaque coolness which he wanted to touch. The size of her eyes, which seemed to fill half her face. The unconscious provocation of her lips. And the use of the word Madame before her name. "Captain Curry, of the Katanga Army," said Bruce. "She's too young to be married. Can't be more than 17. She's still got that little girl freshness about her, and I bet she smells like an unweaned puppy." "Thank you for coming, monsieur." She had a throatiness in her voice, as though she were just about to laugh or to make love, and Bruce added 3 years to his estimate of her age. That was not a little girl's voice, nor were those little girls' legs in the jeans. And little girls had less under their shirt fronts. His eyes came back to her face, and he saw that there was colour in her cheeks now, and sparks of annoyance in her eyes. "My God," he thought, "I'm ogling her like a matelot on shore leave." He hurriedly transferred his attention back to Boussier, but his throat felt constricted as he asked, "How many are you?" "There are 42 of us, of which 5 are women and 2 are children." Bruce nodded. It was what he had expected. The women could ride in one of the covered coaches. He turned and surveyed the railway yard. "Is there a turntable on which we can revolve the locomotive?" he asked Boussier. "No, Captain." They would have to reverse all the way back to M'Sapa Junction, another complication. It would be more difficult to keep a watch on the tracks ahead, and it would mean a sooty and uncomfortable journey. "What precautions have you taken against attack, monsieur?" "They are inadequate, Captain," Boussier admitted. "I have not sufficient men to defend the town. Most of the population left before the emergency. Instead, I have posted sentries on all the approaches, and I have fortified the hotel to the best of my ability. It was there that we intended to stand in the event of attack." Bruce nodded again and glanced up at the sun. It was already reddening as it dropped towards the horizon, perhaps another hour or two of daylight. "Monsieur, it is too late to entrain all your people and leave before nightfall. I intend to load their possessions this evening. We will stay overnight and leave in the early morning. We are all anxious to be away from this place. We have twice seen large parties of Baluba on the edge of the jungle." "I understand," said Bruce. "But the dangers of travelling by night exceed those of waiting another 12 hours. "The decision is yours," Boussier agreed. "What do you wish us to do now?" "Please see to the embarkation of your people. I regret that only the most essential possessions may be entrained. We will be almost 100 persons." "I shall see to that myself," Boussier assured him. "And then?" "Is that the hotel?" Bruce pointed across the street at one of the large double-storied buildings. It was only 200 yards from where they stood. "Yes, Captain." "Good," said Bruce. "It is close enough. Your people can spend the night there in more comfort than aboard the train." He looked at the girl again. She was watching him with a small smile on her face. It was a smile of almost maternal amusement, as though she were watching a little boy playing at soldiers. Now it was Bruce's turn to feel annoyed. He was suddenly embarrassed by his uniform and epaulettes, by the pistol at his hip, the automatic rifle across his shoulder, and the heavy helmet on his head. "I will require someone who is familiar with the area to accompany me. I want to inspect your defences," he said to Boussier. Madame Cartier could show you, suggested Boussier's wife artlessly. I wonder if she noticed our little exchange, thought Bruce. Of course she did. All women have a most sensitive nose for that sort of thing. Will you go with the captain, Charmaine? Asked Madame Boussier. As the captain wishes. She was still smiling. That is settled, then, said Bruce gruffly. I will meet you at the hotel in 10 minutes, after I have made arrangements here. He turned back to Boussier. You may proceed with the embarkation, monsieur. Bruce left them and went back to the train. Hendry, he shouted, you and Asuria will stay on board. We're not leaving until the morning, but these people are going to load their stuff now. In the meantime, rig the searchlights to sweep both sides of the track and make sure the Brens are properly sighted. Hendry grunted an acknowledgement without looking at Bruce. Mike, take 10 men with you and go to the hotel. I want you there in case of trouble during the night. Okay, Bruce. Ruffy? Sa. Take a gang and help the driver refuel. Okay, boss. Hey, boss. Yes? Bruce turned to him. When you go to the hotel, have a look-see. Maybe they got some beer up there. We're just about fresh out. I'll keep it in mind. Thanks, boss. Ruffy looked relieved. I'd hate like hell to die of thirst in this hole. The townsfolk were streaming back towards the hotel. The girl, Charmaine, walked with the Boussiers, and Bruce heard Hendry's voice above him. Jesus, look what that pretty's got in her pants. Whatever it is, one thing's sure. It's round, and it's in 2 pieces. And those pieces move like they don't belong to each other. You haven't any work to do, Hendry? Bruce asked harshly. What's wrong, Curry? Hendry jeered down at him. You got plans yourself. Is that it, Bucko? She's married, said Bruce, and immediately was surprised that he had said it. Sure, laughed Hendry. All the best ones are married. That don't mean a thing, not a bloody thing. Get on with your work, snapped Bruce, and then to Haig. Are you ready? Come with me, then.